Look, it's all going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. Look, yeah, all right, we lost 2-1. It doesn't matter. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Albion Roar. We are live at the Open Market here in central Brighton on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB and on our podcast. My name's Alan Wares and this show is brought to you by the kind, dedicated and omnipresent association of oldfootballshirts.com. Thank you, Phil. I know you're not listening, you're driving away, so thanks for all your support. The international break obviously did the Albion the world of good as they recorded their first win in the top flight since the match at the Goldstone Ground against Coventry on the 23rd of April 1983 with a healthy 3-1 win over West Bromwich Albion last week. Two goals from the much noticed Pascal Gross, who also provided Tom Ahmed with a third, helped seal the points. Last night, a reverse of fortunes as we schlepped 90 miles along the coast to the searing football hotbed that is AFC Bournemouth, where the Albion let a 1-0 lead slip with two well-taken goals from the home side, left Houghton frustrated. This week, my notes say, I am joined by two raw virgins, but one of them can't make it. So thank heavens for a raw substitute. Ayhan Suleiman is a West Stand Upper season ticket holder who's not long come over to us from the dark side. He once supported Manchester United. And I would say he is joined by his son Kane, but Kane isn't able to make it here today. So stepping at the last minute, thanks very much indeed. Welcome back, Marcus Hancocks. Gentlemen, are you okay?
Yeah, fine. Yeah,
all good. All good. Happy to be here.
Really?
Yeah. Well,
didn't we get you out of bed?
It got me out of bed.
Well, you'd have only sulked, wouldn't you? Ayhan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Fabulous name. What's the background? What's your where's Ayhan come from?
Well, I'm born and bred in Brighton to both Turkish Cypriot parents. So obviously brought up in Shaftesbury Road.
Okay, who Marcus, do you know where Shaftesbury Road is?
Struggling to think where Shaftesbury Road is, and I've been born here and bred here and lived here all my life.
Okay, well, rewind to 1975 here. And
I was three.
I was six. And the thing is, what it is, I got older in Shaftesbury Road, which is just up Clyde Road from Preston Circus.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Right.
And back in the mid 70s, I remember this, the Suleimans had a corner shop on the corner of Clyde Road and Shaftesbury Road. Anyone that knows this area will know that shop isn't there anymore. So it was the family shop. There was two older brothers. There was Solomon and Mehmet. Yes?
Correct, yes.
And then what happened in 1975?
Well, sweet little me was born. As my parents put it, I was a bit of an accident because there's 13 and 15 years older, 13 and 15 years difference between me and my two older brothers.
Right.
As I like to say, best looking accident that you'll ever see. Sweet little me popped along and
right, the point I'm making here is that wherever it is you were growing up, Marcus, we were able to play out in the street,
yeah,
without the fear of being run over by anything, and you know, sort of strange men that approached you in those days, you didn't go along with them, you kicked them in the nuts and off they went. And everyone used to play out in the street, and there was a kind of a community of kids playing out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was little you, sort of trying to run around after your brothers, big brothers. And how was it your mum used to call you back in? Sorry, I do apologise to everyone here. There's a little bit of an in-joke here, isn't there?
I think I will leave that to you, because you are better placed. You can do a much better impression of my mother than I can.
The look on Marcus's face there.
So, okay, so picture the scene. I'm out playing in the street with all the kids, having fun, and then all of a sudden you hear fantastic. And that would cause me...
Is your mother listening to this, by the way?
No, she won't be.
Okay.
She won't be.
Are you going to play this to her?
Possibly. Depends how it ends up.
Okay.
Of course, that got me extremely embarrassed.
Yes.
And copious amounts of insults would be thrown my way.
Because you were literally the baby on the block, the new kid on the block.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Fabulous. Because the other thing that I sort of, you know, lost contact with until such times I saw your name in the Stadium Yes book. Do you remember the big sort of hardback book that came out?
Yes, I do, yes.
And I saw the name, I thought, counted on my fingers, hang on. He must be about 40 now. I wonder if it's the same fella. Caught up with you, and lo and behold, you haven't changed a bit from the baby that you were when your mum used to shout,
Like polyfiller works wonders. So yeah.
So in in that case, in terms of football, tell us about your Albion supporting in between 1975 and now. Tell us about football supporting history.
Okay, so basically, I was first and foremost a Brighton fan, absolutely 100%. I remember.
So my intro wasn't strictly true.
Well, no, wasn't strictly true. I mean, yeah, as far as I was concerned, Brighton was my home side. And that's the team that I was going to support, as it should be. I remember strolling down to the...
Mark's is giggling. I think someone's tickling his...
Do you remember the sports shop along London Road?
A.A. Baker.
Yes, that's right. Yep. And I remember buying the...
Where Al Campo is now.
Yes, that's correct.
You probably haven't been there lately. Everyone knows it's the Sankey Hall.
Right, okay.
Remember the gas... Marks is looking puzzled here as well, but yeah. We're talking about, you know, where Al Campo on London Road.
Yeah, Al Campo.
Used to be A.A. Baker was there, the sports shop.
Oh, was it?
Do you remember?
I can't remember what it was before, some sort of community hall. Anyway, come on.
So
remember.
The sports shop, yeah.
Yeah, strutting down there with my mum. Yeah. You know, I was going to buy the complete.
Did you strut in those days?
Oh, yes. Oh,
okay,
of course.
Fine,
I mean, I was a cool 8-9 year old.
Of course.
And yeah, I remember coming out there proud as punch with my full British Caledonian Albion kit.
Yes.
And wearing that out in the street. And of course, a couple of the other kiddies were, you know, sort of die hard Man United fans.
Right.
So there was obviously that little bit of friction and rivalry, friction friendly rivalry going on. And of course, you know, who remembers the FA Cup final when that happened?
Yes.
In the first leg, and then that happened in the second leg.
Well, I don't know if we say the first leg as if we were due to play them twice.
Well, no, exactly. Of course. So I remember there was, you know...
Smith hadn't cocked it up, we wouldn't have had to have had the second leg.
Exactly. But there was obviously a lot of banter flying around at that point. Yeah. And, you know, I was, oh, yeah, of course, you know, we're going to do you. Of course, that's not quite what happened. And obviously, after we lost in the second game, I was really licking my wounds and felt very frustrated. I thought, right, that's it. Fed up of being a Brighton fan, I'm going to switch to Man United.
Oh, dear.
There you go. I've said it. It's documented. I'm kind of using this as therapy as well to help get over that
this childhood trauma
stage of being in the dark side.
All we need now is a couch now and just lay him down, microphone underneath him, and we'd be.
But the thing is, I mean, yeah, okay, I did it. There you go. I said it. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, I always looked out for Albion. I was always an Albion fan in my heart. It was just, you know, you wanted success. The other kids, you know, they were enjoying the success. I wanted to be like them. There was a bit of pressure there, I guess. It was, you know, lowly Brighton or, you know, big
Almighty
Man United.
Yeah,
exactly. So you can kind of get in them days why perhaps a lot of the kids may have decided to have supported some of the bigger clubs.
Yeah, my day at school, it was Liverpool. Obviously, Liverpool were the team that people wanted to support all the time and get the glory. Man United didn't win much in those days. It was all Liverpool this and Liverpool that.
Did you ever waver, Marcus, even in the dark days?
I did. Yeah. Well, not in the dark days of the Albion, but in my formative years before I nailed my colours to the mast as a sort of teenager. So I came quite late to the Albion party. I started in about 88. So,
you'd have been about, 16 then, yeah?
Yeah.
How many did your school days then?
Well, really into football. Even though Mum said take him. Sorry, I'm taking over now.
And
a lot of my friends sort of supported Liverpool and Tottenham and all that, and I just sort of, I support Liverpool as well, even though I never really supported anybody, really. But then I went along to the Goldstone, bought a Sabutio set with some of my friends and thought, right, I'm going to go and watch a professional football team play. Who's local? Oh, Brighton are local. I'll go and watch them. And then it was Sunderland at home. We won 3-0. Nelson, Chivers... can't remember, it might have been Bremner, something like that. And from that day on, I was hooked. And I went back next week and the week after, and then I started listening to them on the radio, Hull City away. We lost 5-2. I was in Gamblers at the time. I remember this sort of stuff. And then,
no, absolutely.
And it just carried on from there. And then obviously Brighton got worse and worse, but my attendance went up and up and up. So it's my fault, really.
Marcus the donor. So in all this time, we are 10 minutes into the show, and I haven't asked the question that we always ask of someone who's on for the first time. What was your first game then, Ihan?
It was Watford at home.
What year?
At the Goldstone. It was, just trying to think, I was probably about 15 at the time.
I remember 1990. Okay. So, David, hang on, is this the game that...
That would have been either 0-1 or 1-0.
What was the final score?
I think there was one goal. I cannot remember. It was
David James in goal?
No, that was in the season before. Or season after, I think. He was 91.
What was that?
We won. Okay. I'm trying to think myself.
Mutter, yeah.
But it was North Stand with a bunch of my mates, and it was so much fun. It really was.
you went straight to the North?
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Didn't break me in gently, straight in there.
Did you break your
I went straight into the North Stand. Stood to slightly to in the North Stand goal, so I would have been slightly to the left. And some bloke said,
Towards
the eastern side. And some bloke, I was there as a sort of spotty teenager of a couple of my mates, and some bloke thrust a goal's eye in my hand and went, "Have a read of that, mate. It's really great," because it had a caricature of Steve Penny on the front, because where he said he wasn't going to play for Albion again, and then next week he did play for the Albion again, if that makes sense.
Let's say fans are fickle. And so in all this time then, Ihan, what were we talking about, so 27 years, who's been your all-time Albion favourite Albion player, and I've got to say the ones that you've seen play?
So that would obviously be more recently then, because I jumped back onto the Albion bandwagon probably about a year and a half to 2 years. The last year and a half to 2 years at Withdean.
Right.
So
that's quite a hiatus you had then.
Yes, it was. It was. As I said, I mean, I'd always check the Albion scores week in, week out, and have a little look and see how they were doing.
Box ticked,
and,
exactly.
You know, read the back, back of the Evening Argus just to see, you know, the match reports and stuff like that.
So your favourite player.
My favourite player would probably be.
It's all right. We've got a game on Tuesday. When you're ready.
If I was to say, perhaps Vicente would have been one of the favourite players. Actually, I mean, that was, you know, he was a bit of a spectacle when he was fit to watch. I'd say in the Withdean years, I mean, Nicky Forster.
Okay.
You know,
he was. He always gave it his all. I feel.
Until such time as he decided that he wanted a new contract, and Gus.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, sort
just
of.
Showed him a door.
Yeah, called his bluff. Nicky Forster.
That ended a bit bitterly.
I'm sure we must have asked you so many times, Marcus. What's yours?
Mine? Yeah. Well, now, head and shoulders above the great Sir Bob, is the man himself, Mr. Murray.
I really love him.
Yeah, I think he's a brilliant striker. Absolutely. I mean, he's not done so well this season, but I was so sad to see him go. He was probably the best striker I've seen play for the Albion, bar Mr. Zamora. I mean, his goal ratio, I think it's 1-2, 1-3. It's fantastic.
1-2.5,
honestly,
something like that. And at a high level as well.
Yeah, fabulous. I love him.
Okay, should we talk about our first win in the Premier League for...
Yes.
Ever. Okay, the team was unchanged from the one which started at Watford the week previously, which meant Isquiardo, brackets Aspinall, was still on the subs bench. Tony Pulis was therefore free to do a lot of screaming and gesticulating, though Houghton was outdoing that by hysterically being caught on TV blowing his nose and pointing at something somewhere towards Ditchling Beacon. From the outset, Brighton looked up for it, possibly stung by criticism of not scoring. So Marcus, you go first. What did you make of the overall performance?
The overall performance of the entire match, I thought we were absolutely brilliant for about 80 of those minutes. Literally 80 of those minutes we controlled the match. And West Brom had a couple of pot shots, but nothing, you know, in the first half. I think Gareth Barry had one that sort of stung Ryan's hands, but, you know, overall we looked very much in control. It was a very good Albion performance.
I didn't recognise Gareth Barry at first because he didn't have a seagull on his head.
No, exactly. All standing on Brighton Beach.
So of course,
we wouldn't have recognised him. But West Brom, you know, solid, decent Premier League mid-table outfit. You know, it's fair to say, because that's what they are and that's what they've been for the last God knows how many years now.
Yeah. Well, they were a yo-yo club for a while,
they
weren't
they? And then they've cemented themselves since probably, I'd say the early 2000s maybe. I'm trying to think. But the point being is that, you know, there's two sides to look at this. West Brom probably had a bad day, it's fair to say, because I expected more from them. But I don't want to take anything away from what was a very, very, very good Brighton performance.
Ihan, what changed then? I mean, this is what, the fourth game in the leagues, the season. What changed from the I suppose the Watford game, we didn't play too badly, just didn't stick the ball away. But what changed? What felt different?
I mean, it almost looked as if a certain element of fear had just kind of lifted from the team. I think that was definitely apparent, in the City game and the Leicester game. perhaps maybe the first half of the Watford game as well, even when even after Watford went down to 10 men. It still looked like that there was that kind of element of fear slightly, and then obviously once we kind of settled into the game further, obviously Watford were down to 10 men, we started to get back in, and then we played with a lot more confidence. A little bit more like what we were used to, obviously, last season.
Feel like a performance that we'd put in last season in the Championship. Admittedly, we'd have been playing against lesser sides, but the whole mm-hmm. feel of the game where we kind of outfought them in almost every department, you know, it felt like we were playing one of the top sides in the Championship. It felt that it had that kind of feel to
it. That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, and you know, when I say what changed, who came to the party then? Because previously we'd had, you know, Bruno and March were just about the only ones that had stepped up previously, and so who else came to the party
for the West Brom game?
For us, for the West Brom game. Yeah.
Just about everybody, I think. It would have been very difficult to choose a man of the match. Someone who is getting better, who I would have happily have driven.
I was about to say, you've always got someone.
No, seriously, proper after that Man City game, I was ready to drive into Holland and say, "You stay there, mate." But game on game, he's getting better and better and better, and. You know, he was very good against West Brom. Gross was better, obviously, because of his contribution. But they're slowly bedding in, these players now.
Is it a classic thing that we've got that we expect too much too soon? I mean, let's rewind to last year, beginning of last season, and Shane Duffy. You know, he'd scored a couple of own goals for Blackburn and was kind of coming across as a. Well, he was a bit of a donkey up there and made his debut against Newcastle, didn't exactly shine, and people were quick to criticise. People were quick to write him off. And do you think that so many people have done that this season for, well, too many of our players so far?
Yeah, I'd say definitely. But there's always going to be, you know, an element of fans that are going to criticise, no matter what the situation is. Me, personally, I thought that I would reserve judgment until at least maybe half a dozen games into the season.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, it was, you know, it's there's a fair few players in the team now that are new. They came in. Well, a couple of them came in sort of reasonably late
late in the close season.
So there wasn't really that much time for the team to gel really before the season started. I think, and also it's a new league.
Mm.
You know, it's completely different. It's a huge step up, as we all know, from the Championship to the Premier League. And so I think, you know, the team would also need a little bit of time to bed in and get used to the speed of the game. I mean, you can watch it on TV, you can train 10 times harder than you did in the previous season, but there's nothing like obviously playing the game.
Mm.
And getting to grips with the speed and the physicality. It's completely
and the mistakes
different.
As well yeah. in this league. Mm. They are ruthlessly punished.
And it's something absolutely.
That, I know I'm jumping ahead a bit, but you know, the Albion players need to start getting it drilled into their heads pretty quickly. You know,
mistakes are not going to be tolerated.
In a Championship, you can sometimes just about get away with it, unless you're playing really one of the real quality Championship sides who have a, you know, a laser sharp strike force.
Yes.
But in this division, even teams like Bournemouth and Leicester and
everyone
will pick up Palace.
God forbid, they'll get punished. I've told you about this. Can you please warn me if you're going to swear on air? We haven't got a beat machine here. So
no, I won't, please, don't worry.
Please,
I
don't please
have.
So you mentioned
I'm not a tiller.
Phew. I mean, you mentioned proper there. What did he do to the kind of so impress you?
He now seems to believe he was a rabbit caught in the headlights on the first game, I'll be honest, and maybe I expected better for £10 million. If he was a free transfer from somewhere, you think, okay mate, you're doing your best, and
yeah.
Fair enough. And I think for that sort of money, I expect him to come in and be, you know, the dogs from day one, you know, and quite clearly he wasn't, but it caught him by surprise. I think he was a rabbit caught in the headlights, but every game he's now been better and better, and he's kept possession and he's quite calm and he's starting to put the miles in as well, and he's now starting to pick out some passes as well. He's been really, and he's actually last two or three games he's been better than Dale, although again I'm jumping ahead again, but Dale came to the party against Bournemouth, probably against West Brom he was one of the sort of first reserves, shall we say.
You mentioned his transfer fee there. Do you think, Ayhan, that the transfer fee should be directly indicative of a player's quality. I mean, you know, you mentioned whatever it was, 10 million we got him for, but as Marcus said, if we picked him up for a song, we'd be a bit more forgiving. Do you think that's a fair way of looking at it?
Well, I think it's easy to put a huge weight of expectation on a player that has had X amount of million pounds spent on him. Especially if you're kind of, you know, a player like Davey Proper, I'd say the majority of Albion fans probably wouldn't know too much about him.
No.
So came with that price tag, you're expecting him to be almost a world beater. I don't tend to look at the price of a player, to be honest with you. Or in this particular situation, I wasn't really looking at the price of the player. It was more about, you know, how
the haircut, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. If it was a $10 million haircut, fine. going back to your original sort of question, it's understandable that there will be a weight of expectation, but there's so many variables in this game. You know, it's how they get on with their teammates, how they get on with the manager, how they get on with the, with the town, you know, the environment in which they live in. I like to think that those variables are more positive, certainly with this club, because it's a great place to live. You do seem to feel that there is an excellent team ethic at the club. You've got a great manager, you've got a chairman that is first and foremost a fan and loves the club from the bottom of his heart. So, you know, all the elements are there for it to be an excellent environment to work in. But that still doesn't mean that the player is going to, you know, slot straight into.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, I'll always go back to, you know, all about 10 years ago when we bought Forster and Murray, and that not that far apart. And I think Murray was 300 grand, Forster was 75 grand. And you think, well, does that mean that Murray's four times better than Forster? And of course, it doesn't work that way. Should we talk about the goals?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, well, let's talk about the disallowed one first. March's shot was fumbled by Foster. Former England keeper, therefore he's got a fumble in him. In the West Brom goal, three players were on hand to pick up any mess, and Duffy duly obliged. Sadly, all three were offside, but do you think it was kind of indicative of an attacking intent?
Yeah, definitely. Fair play to the linesman, the flag went straight up, and looking at the replays,
no argument, but but the fact is that one, March was going to have a shot. Two, it was on target.
Yeah,
three,
exactly.
The keeper, Julia, but yeah. And the West Brom defence, yeah, it got out, but it was, you know, did they know that we were going to be offside at the time? You know, so, but let's talk about the history making one, as they like to go on and on and on about it on Match of the Day. A long crossfield pass from Pascal Gross finds Solly March, or Ollie March as Motti called him, on the left. He teases his man before floating return ball to Gross on the far post. He has enough time to take it down and squeeze a shot through a crowd of legs past Foster. Brighton's first goal in the top flight since Gordon Smith against Norwich. Fun, that celebration, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we all went absolutely mental.
Yeah.
And rightly so. I think we'd had so much tension bottled up after the first three games that it just all erupted. I mean, that
do you feel it was deserved on the balance of play?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I'm glad it went in, but it was one of those sort of goals where it was sort of, you know,
as he messed it up here.
No, is it in the net?
In my mind, and I think a couple of other people picked up on it, there was a brief pause in between it hitting the back of the net and everyone going up.
Yeah.
You know, you think, he's done. I mean, you now can actually then verbalise it and say, oh my God, it's in the back of the net, he's done it, yes, we've scored. Now that takes about 3 seconds to say, but it's actually just that whole lot is processed in your head and it just comes out as
That's basically what happened, because I mean, maybe where we are in a West Upper, but we're level with the North Stand goal, and of course that goal was scored in the South Stand.
Yes.
And so from that angle you sort of see the player sort of almost wheeling away, and then you realise that, you know, the ball's in the net
I suppose people at the far end can't see it's gone in because the West Brom players are in the way rather than seeing the net bulge and, you know, Foster thumping the ground. So
I think Gross actually said he didn't realise that it went in because there were so many bodies in the way. Yeah, initially.
What was he trying to do then?
Well, obviously he went for the shot and there was obviously a few bodies in the way, a little bit of pinball, and then it went into the back of the net.
Yes.
But I think he said that he didn't actually see it cross the line, and then I think obviously the reaction of the teammates going absolutely mental.
Well, okay, so that was about a minute before half time, and then about a minute after half time, Lewis Dunk makes his way forward to the halfway line on the left hand side before being stopped, and this is where Pulis thought was a foul, the silly person. The ball falls to Solly March, who plays it up to Hemed, who showed good strength to hold off his man and play it around the corner to an unmarked Gross. Despite Knockhart screaming for the ball, the German hit a low shot past the far post, past Foster. Could you believe it?
These things don't happen, do they? No, they don't. They don't. And, you know, many a time you would have seen a shot like that be sort of parried away by the keeper.
Tipped around the post or
Exactly. I mean, should have Ben Foster done better, perhaps. But do you know what? I don't actually care.
No, should
Foster have done better? Or was it just the fact that, all right, it was along the ground, but it was just perfectly placed? He put it in a place that the keeper couldn't reach.
I've watched that goal again, and I'm sort of, but even in real time, firstly, big up to Hemed. That was an absolutely
awesome.
I was waxing lyrical last week in the cricketers about it, and I've not seen someone hold a ball up like that since Mickey Small in the playoff semi final against Millwall.
And holding the ball up like that is not what
years ago.
Holding the ball up like that is not what I call Hemed's forte.
No,
either.
Absolutely. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant. But as soon as that ball left Gross's foot, I knew it was going in.
Yeah.
As soon as he went to shoot, it was like, which was the right decision.
Yes.
You know, I know Knockhart was
screaming. Well, because it went in.
Well, of course it went in. But there was no doubt that was going in. I just had no doubt. As soon as he thwacked it, that was it. I was already celebrating before it hit the back of the net because I knew it was going in. There's no mistake.
It was
absolutely
very nicely done. And then goal three, good tenacity from Gross, means that West Brom can't keep the ball. March plays it up the line to an on-running Gross, who plays the ball in for Hemed to get across his man for once and power the header in off the near post. I think that's the one that everyone was on Match of the Day was sort of waxing lyrical about, was just the sort of centre forward's powerful header, and we're going to need that sort of thing from Hemed / Murray / new striker, aren't we?
Well, I think, I mean, to be honest, if you go back a few passes from the point where Hemed actually heads it into the goal, I think if I remember rightly, we were coming down the left and I think we lost the ball and it kind of came loose. It was almost a 50-50 ball and I can't remember who won it back, but that just showed for me, that showed just that extra little step up that we took to be determined to win that ball. Just that little passage of play there, which then allowed the ball to go down the left, be crossed in, and then be you know, whacked in the back of the
net.
I think Hemed
was an outstanding goal from him, and there was a couple of times in the first half where, again, it's the old Earl Murray would have scored that, where the ball came over for a cross and Hemed wasn't instinctive enough. It sort of stood there waiting for it to land on his head, and it's like, mate, it's not going to land on your head, mate. You've got to get in front of that defender and start attacking the ball, which is what Murray or any of Zamora or any of those strikes would have done. So, I mean, that's that goal, as much as I thought, and I love Hemed, he'll run for a brick wall for you, he will. And I was so pleased that he actually scored, because he was, in that second half, he was immense.
He was blowing chunks, wasn't he?
He was immense, and to be fair, he should have probably been substituted earlier, not because of his performance, but literally because he was knackered.
He was dead on his feet, wasn't he?
Battered and bruised, but he'd shown signs of it against Watford. There were a couple of times against Watford where he just got in front of the defender.
He got in front of his man and hit the post, didn't he?
So. Exactly. So, you know, he can do it. But the trouble is, Hemed, you need to do it for 90 minutes, son.
Well,
you can't wait till the second half.
Absolutely. But there's one thing, in all the, you know, plaudits, Match of the Day, and we're talking about Gross and Hemed feeding each other and what have you, but involved in all three goals is Solly March. Now, I think that we were fairly confident he was going to make the step up, but he's made that step up, hasn't he, to the Premier League?
Yeah, absolutely, no question.
Yeah.
Oh, it gives me immense pleasure to see him do so well.
With one caveat: don't dive.
Oh yeah, that dive was appalling against West Brom. It was right in front of us. And he'd done so well, and then you do that.
I didn't see that.
What did you see, Ahan?
Arsene Wenger.
What did you see? Come on.
He got taken out blatantly.
Oh yeah.
Of course.
I didn't realise AD was on the show.
Yeah, sniper in the West Stand. Yeah. Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, or maybe on our podcast. And as ever, thank you very much, as I said at the top of the show, to Phil Shelley, our sponsor of oldfootballshirts.com. And we have another Shirt of the Week, which he's dug out. Now, he sent that to me. I'm going to show it to you on my phone. So if you want to take that zoom in on it. Now, he's given me the unphotoshopped badge, so you can actually read what it says.
Oh, okay.
But could you describe
it? I'll try and describe it. I know we get a bit of... Right, it's made by Araya.
Right.
It's basically grey. I'm not sure what colour
grey
you
indigo.
Would say. So it's not even indigo. No, right. It's... Well, it could be the sort of England away indigo grey. It's a grey shirt, basically. Right. And then right down the middle, there's a series of dots that look like the opening credits of Doctor No, with the yes, with the okay. sort of James Bond dots. Some of them are red, some of them are white, all the way just down the
bit
middle of the shirt.
Pop art, isn't it?
Yeah, very pop art. And then there's a badge with a with some sort of, I don't know, what do you reckon that is on there? There's a
Samsung
sea lion
Sport
or something, is it?
I don't know.
Okay, shall I and maybe you might
capitated need capitated there perhaps, I'm not sure.
How is your Turkish, by the way, Ayhan?
Not bad.
Not bad. I mean, do you speak it like a native?
No. No, not at all. Not at all.
That you are a native, I say. No. So, okay, here we go. I picked this one, hopefully with your guest in mind. That's you,
Ayhan.
And I hope it's not a team they don't like. It's a 2013 third shirt of Turkish First League side Samsunspor. The First League is, of course, the second division in Turkey. Samsunspor are known as Kırmızı Şimşekler. Yes?
Say again?
Kırmızı Şimşekler, a nickname I could immediately translate. It means red lightning.
Okay. Yeah, the second bit, Şimşekler, yeah.
Şimşekler.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, pronunciation needs a little bit work, but well, no, that's not too
well,
bad.
I've got the S with the cedilla on it. I know that's a shirt, isn't it?
Yes, okay. It is.
Not to be confused with Kırmızı Yıldırım, though. What does that mean?
I don't know.
Okay. Which is something slightly different. They play at the 33,919 capacity Canik or Çanak 19 Mayıs Stadium in the city of Samsun on the north coast of Turkey on the Black Sea. Samsunspor were formed in 1965 and have played at all levels of Turkish football. They qualified for the Intertoto Cup twice in 97 and 98, and at a later tournament they knocked out the burning smell from up the A23 in the third round, beating them 2-0 home and away.
Excellent.
Serkan Aykut is Samsunspor's most revered player, making 320 appearances during the two stints at the club between 95 and 2009, scoring 171 times. In 1987, former Samsunspor striker Tanju Çolak became the only Turkish player to win the UEFA Golden Shoe. I do love that, Golden Shoe. It's a boot. Was it a brogue or maybe a, you know, moccasin? Scoring 39 times for Galatasaray that season. For links to the UK, I see that former Man City, Celtic and West Brom attacker and Greek international Georgios Samaras signed for them this season. And Londoner Billy Mehmet spent his formative years as a youth player at West Ham before playing 220 times in Scotland for St Mirren's, Dunfermline, before moving to Turkey in 2011. Phil, thank you very much indeed for that Shirt of the Week. I do love the fact we have this visual thing of Shirt of the Week on the radio. It's wonderful. Brilliant. Desegregation, which is kind of, it's not the hot topic of the week, but something has happened this week which I think actually can throw up a few more bits of conversation. Now, 20,000 Cologne fans descended on London this week, having bought 2,900 tickets. It wasn't the riot that was reported in the hate sheets. But the point is that there was an awful lot of Cologne fans made it into the home end. Has the time come for a debate on, if not total desegregation, then an area not dissimilar to what Fulham are doing, of having a neutral area whereby home fans and away fans, as well as neutral fans, can sit? Is football too geared? Is the culture too geared in this country to have home fans, away fans, and it's illegal to blend the two?
It's a good question. Personally, I
know what one would prefer, but obviously we've got to consider everyone.
I wouldn't be against it, but I wouldn't want any away fans sitting next to me at an Albion game. So I'd be as far away from the neutral / you know, comfort zone, whatever you want to call it, as possible, because I want to be with Brighton fans.
But what about as an away fan in the home end, and away fan in the home end yourself? Because if I recall rightly, now it just occurs to me, there was probably one of the most famous Albion games in history. And you sat in the home end. You had to sit in your hands.
I had to sit on my hands.
Do tell.
That was horrible. So I'm
do not, tell.
Well,
go
when
on.
I was at Hereford, obviously I couldn't get a ticket for the away end. So my uncle lives in Gloucester. So he put a call in at Hereford because obviously they wouldn't suspect anything because of his accent, because he's got more of a Gloucestershire burr than my dad does, because he's been down here for many, many years. And and they got sent to his house in Cheltenham. I had three tickets for the home end at Hereford, and obviously that was a horrible,
well, yes.
horrible experience, but a good experience nonetheless. But you have to sit on your hands. I mean, you know, and away fans do, of course. Away fans get in all the time in home ends. Of course they do, but it's how they then respond. I mean, do they do what I do, which is just, you know, you just keep your head down, and, you know, you don't go bat mental when, you know, Robbie Rinehart cracks in the equaliser. You know, I mean, crikey. Just sort of clench your hands in your pocket, and, you know, and when Hereford score, you just sort of look a bit unemotional. But, you know, there are people who get into the... I've seen it. How many times have we seen it at a Goldstone and with Dean at Amex? Even at the Amex, where, you know, the opposition are scoring, and all of a sudden all these away fans are all sort of, you know, jumping up, celebrating.
It happened a lot, actually, at Villa, actually, at the end of last season.
Yeah, precisely. Exactly. That's another... Yes, because I know a number of Albion fans have got tickets in the Villa end just because...
Because they hadn't sold their bit out.
Yeah.
I mean, they had...
And they kept a top tier empty as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah. Which we could have filled.
So, you know, it happened. It does happen in football. You can't say it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But for me personally, if they're going to do that, then you need, like Fulham have done, a neutral area type.
Mm-hmm. I suppose there's an argument I had, because, you know, with safe standing has been a topic of conversation over the past couple of years whereby we're not talking about the entire stadium being safe standing, we're talking about a given area. So the choice would be, if you want to be in a given area and you want to do X, in this instance stand, or are prepared to be in a neutral section, you can be, as opposed to, I want to be in the home end, I want to be in the away end, I don't want to sort of have this mingling. I mean, obviously at the Amex, you have the mingling before and after the game, but during it, you kind of want to be there. So, are you with Marcus on the lines of those that want to do it, fine, go ahead, you're not against that idea, or do you think, no, it should be, we should just carry on, because so far, roughly, it's worked?
I'd probably be inclined to agree more with Marcus, actually. I think for those that want it, if it's available, fine. I have experienced the neutral end at Craven Cottage, and it's quite an interesting dynamic, to
go
be
on.
Honest with you.
Yeah,
I've never been in there, haven't
you? So, it's we couldn't, obviously the away tickets had sold out, so we obviously had to opt for the neutral end, and it's interesting. At one point when the game kicked off, I kind of forgot that I was in the neutral end. And if I remember rightly, if my memory serves me correct, Fulham had scored first. And there's a few pockets of fans in, and I think that sort of jumped up to celebrate. And then I realised where I was, which then actually made the goals that we scored even sweeter, because you're actually sort of right next to them, and you can sort of...
And did we outnumber them in the neutral bit?
Yes, we did.
It sounds like Star Trek, doesn't it? We're in the neutral
zone. We did. So, like I said, interesting dynamic insofar as, you know, when they score, obviously you'll have maybe, you know, the couple in front jump up, but then, you know, when you score, you can kind of give it some back. In terms of, you know, overall...
I mean, is Fulham a kind of place that can... I mean, with the exception possibly when they play QPR or Chelsea or something, or even Brentford... is that the kind of place that actually lends itself to it? Whereas certain places, you know, you could never have it at, say, Elland Road or at the Den or something like that. So is somewhere like Fulham, you know, just a kind of a really good example as to what can be done?
Yeah, I think so. You could do it. I mean, you could do it at the Amex if we were playing, I don't know, let's pick Barnsley at home. Quite easily do that. They're not going to bring that many anyway. So, you know, you can sort of stick a few neutrals in there if you really wanted to and sort of segregate a bit further. But, you know, obviously Palace at home. No, come on. No.
Well, I remember when... No. I mean, it takes it to the other extreme is that when the stadium opened, you know, they were trying to do the thing of, you know, it's a fairly new concept, even though it's a fairly simple one, of, you know, having home and away fans mingle, you treat them well, they'll behave well, treat them like pigs, they behave like pigs. And the first few games, Doncaster, it worked okay, and I can't remember, I think even Liverpool and Sunderland were down for the League Cup and what have you, and then Palace came down and they tried to do the same, and it sorely backfired, and you get to realise maybe society isn't quite ready for this kind of grown-up attitude just yet. So like you say, I think Brighton against Palace is going to be, you know, it's going to be a tricky one, but...
Thing with Cologne, they brought 20,000 and only sold officially 2,900. But knowing an Arsenal season ticket holder as I do, the Emirates very rarely get sold out anyway, only for the main games, Man City, Man United. The top tier is virtually empty most games. When they say 59,900 against Stoke City at home, they all laugh. Quite clearly, there's 30,000 in the stadium. Yeah, you know, it is the pretendance of extraordinaire. Yeah. However, Cologne snapped up, and they, you know, they don't sell out early Champions League games, let alone they're going to sell out a Europa League game. So those 20,000 fans probably did have tickets, but most of them were in the home end because
they could have actually just stuck Cologne in the top tier then,
which they should have done really, because they so yeah, and 20,000 fans turning up en masse, because you could get a 20,000 away following, but they just all turned up in one go, I think, which took everybody
from Victoria Station,
by surprise.
Didn't
they? Yeah, you know, if they were just coming in sort of fits and starts like most away fans do, like at Wembley when you got,
knowing how much you rant about trains here, and please don't start one of them now, actually it's probably quite grateful that 20,000 fans didn't take the underground for Victoria up to Finsbury Park next to Arsenal's ground, because that would have actually created a bit more sort of human traffic.
Of course,
they walked
they,
didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
There's all the walking through Soho.
And
people
like,
in Cologne going, oh, this is a bit tame, but yeah, no,
Well, you know, they didn't manage to walk through London from 39 and 45, so I suppose.
Marcus,
sorry,
you cannot say that.
Just did. Sorry.
You just did. Okay, well, I think this is a conversation we're going to have. I mean, I think that what there is that I feel, because, you know, I've got a microphone here, is that there is a whole raft of laws pertaining specifically to football, which I think it's about time they were challenged, because we've got the whole thing of drinking on the coaches on the way to a game. We've got drinking inside the pitch. We've got various aspects of social behaviour law which are unique to football, which aren't to cricket, which aren't to rugby, which aren't to other sort of national sports. And one of these things, obviously, is segregation as well. I don't know anyone else out there how they feel about it in Twitter land or Facebook land or radio land. Let us know what you think about the whole concept of the laws that we have which govern football, especially spectators. Do you think they're draconian? Do you think they were based initially on the back of a lie? Everything was post Hillsborough, seeking to assume that, you know, drunken ticketless football fans came along, you know, weed on their compatriots, and, you know, were responsible for the death of 96 people. We now know that was a lie propagated by the authorities. Therefore, so many of the laws that we have, I mean, there's no mistaking that, obviously, sometimes football in the 80s, it was a horrible place to go.
Yeah,
wasn't
I mean, hooliganism was a, you know,
was horrible.
Rife. You can't deny that.
Absolutely.
I know Hillsborough was not the fault of drunken fans, but at the same time, you know, football was a nasty place in the 70s and 80s.
It was.
Well, 70s and most of the 80s,
most
up
the
to
80s,
sort of,
yeah.
You know, the Italian 90 is when it sort of changed
kind
for most
dipped
people.
Dipped a little bit.
But
I think Hillsborough changed a lot of things
and
anyway.
Hillsborough did as well, but it was, you know, it's, the only thing is with cricket and rugby's very stop start, and so is cricket. You know, nothing can happen for hours in cricket, as we all know. Troubles with football, there's so much happening. I would get really fed up with people going in front of me all the time, going up to get drinks and come back and bring them back and stuff like that while a game of football's going on. Rugby's so stop start, you can, you know, by the time they've all lined up and booted it out and rejigged and everything, I think they play about a bit like Andy's American Football Love, where they end up playing, what is it, five minutes out of an hour or something. There's actually about 5 minutes of
game
time.
And that's not counting the TV commercials.
No, that's not counting. So it's, you know, so plenty of time for drinks and snacks and stuff. So I'm not against it, but I think it would be really annoying if everybody was just going for it.
I know that Paul Barber, for instance, is very keen to, I don't think it's top of the club's priorities, but he's very keen to actually look at the whole thing of being able to drink. I mean, it's the half-time thing. I mean, if you want to go for your half-time pint, you've got 15 minutes, and that's 6 to presume you can actually pick it up at the beginning of the half-time break.
Yeah.
If you can't, and you're 10 minutes into it before you get it, you've got to lorry it down or you've got to miss a few minutes.
Yeah.
I don't think it'd be unreasonable to have the bar open during the half-time break, but be able to take that pint back to your seat. You can nurse it for the rest of the half if you felt like it and have it. But if you want another beer, you've got to wait till the game's finished.
Yeah, because then I know what you're saying.
I agree about people sort of like going in front of you.
Yeah, you know, I mean...
Even the Middlesbrough Beam back at the end of a couple of seasons ago, you know, all right, we're watching a game, it's the big screens on the pitch, but what you've got is people going forever either to the loo or to the bar.
Yeah.
I'm watching the game. Go
exactly.
You wouldn't have it at your home, would you?
No, exactly. So I think, you know, there is a case for maybe keeping the bar open longer at half time, as I say, but you still close it 5 minutes into the second half or something.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And then it opens again at full time. So you're not going to get people, as you say, you can nurse your pint, but you're not going to be getting someone who thinks, great, let's have another. You know,
no.
Because there's a few of our friends that we know
who get a little pickled.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Going
in
to
a nice way, I hasten to add. But
going to the football, don't get me wrong, is a great social experience. Isn't it? I mean, for us, we go to see our mates. There's a kind of family and friends thing, often ruined by 90 minutes of football. but it's a sort of kind of drinking gathering place. And I think the nature of, because we spent so much time fighting for our club and we got to know our fellow fans, and I say people in the North Stand that were near me at the goals and didn't have a clue who they were until such time as we're all fighting together to get rid of Archer Velotti, and we've all got a whole new load of friends on the back of that. So you go to the West Stand upper where we are, and you know you're going to see 30, 40, 50 people that you know, never mind the regular faces, people you know, because you're kind of brothers in arms during the struggles. And I say, and to have a pint, even if, you know, while you're watching the match, rather than thinking, oh my God, I'm such a naughty boy, I can't drink, I can have a drink there, but if I step three paces over there, I'll be breaking the law. It's, you know, this is the kind of draconian nonsense we got. So, you know, I think that if there's anyone who wants to have a, you know, sort of add to the debate on this, do drop us a line, and I think that this is a discussion which I don't see why we can't actually sort of, you know, put it to the club's attention and bring it to the fore a bit more. Anyone? Yeah.
No. I think the thing with the culture of drinking goes beyond football. I mean, just generally speaking, our attitudes toward drinking over here are completely different to, say, the attitudes towards drinking on the continent.
Yeah.
Mm. It does seem to be a lot more of a relaxed pace over there. I mean, people do get drunk.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, certainly, you know, over here people sort of go out to have a
until
few
you get
drinks,
to Russia, which is a different thing entirely.
Well, but I think it's also to do with the licensing. Lane's right, but it's also to do with the licensing laws as well. I mean, we've now got a bit more of a relaxation, but you know, all that drinking up before 11, so it's go out, slam a few pints down, and you know, because again, a knock on effect from the war,
from the
First World War, where they didn't want people blowing themselves up and making bombs at 6 o'clock in the morning because I'm still half cut from coming home from the pub the night before.
How many wars are you going to mention today, Marcus?
I'm just saying. That's the fact. That's where the licensing laws came from.
From the Defence of the Realm Act. Absolutely.
We're an agricultural society at heart, so drinking should be all round the clock. You know?
Yeah, so you've seen us play football then, yeah. Okay, well, as well as it being the start of the regular men's season here, the women's season starts on September the 24th. The Albion are playing Durham City. And also, the Power Chair team, their football season starts this weekend. Now, what happens is all teams in the country, Brighton Hove Albion, obviously one of the top teams in the country, finished third in the top division last season and are hoping to do better, even though it was their best finish last year. Their season starts today. They're playing at the moment. And I say at the moment, if you listen to the podcast, they're not playing at the moment. And I've got the latest score. I can tell you that they are 2-1 up at half time against West Brom.
Splendid.
West Brom, I think, are one of those. I think they are known as Sporting Albion, I think. Are one of the top sides. So it's kind of a little bit like Brighton beating, say, Leeds last year. We're kind of better than them, and they're one of the top sides. So, you know, 2-1 up at half time. I think a game they'd expect to win. There's just a couple of teams that are. There's Sporting Thunder and there's Aspire. Those are the two teams that are actually trying to chase down in order to win the title. And as you know, Brighton's Matt Francis played for England during the Summer World Cup, got very respectable third place. Would have had a bronze medal, but they were so tin pot they didn't actually have third place medals. But we're all very proud of him, and you know, and hopefully he'll get to carry on and play for England in the future. Now then, it's the elephant in the room. I was trying to avoid it. We're 48 minutes into the show, but we do have to talk about it. Last night's game. Chris Hughton made one change to the team which beat West Brom. Liam Rossinia, or as his shooting was last night, Liam Rosette, as should be known, came in for the injured Bruno. Aside from that, it was an unchanged side with both March and Knockhart starting. Now, first half, it was pretty much attack against defence, wasn't it?
I think
that your entire report?
Yes. I mean, I think, again, you know, it was... I think we had a similar game plan, or we wanted to have a similar game plan as we did against West Brom. But, I think we did OK. I think we created a few opportunities.
When we're disciplined, we're difficult to break down. City only broke us down because, you know, we made a couple of mistakes. And I think probably in the whole scheme of things last night, we lost because of a couple of defensive mistakes. But when those mistakes aren't there, we're very difficult to break down, aren't we?
Absolutely. Ahan's right. We had the game plan and we stuck to it religiously in that first half. It was attack v's defence, but even Baron Aspinall on the radio, because I sort of had the telly on, but the sort of commentary on the radio, because right. It's better.
Did they marry up?
But not quite, because there's a few seconds delay between radio is actually as it happens, and the telly's always about 5 seconds behind the commentary. So it's really funny, you know, the goal goes in and then people
all right.
Yeah, it goes in on the radio and then you see it on the telly. It's quite funny. However, having said that, you know, and Warren was right, you know, there was no way they were going to beat us in the air. No way at all. No. That Albion defence is as solid. So when we play against the muscle teams like your West Brom, Burnley, Stoke, probably, although they're a bit more cultured now, you know, our friends up the road, you know, they're not many strikers are going to get much joy out of Duffy and Dunk this season, you know, and if you lump it, mate, great. They'll hit it away all day long.
They will.
All day long.
I can't think of too many strikers that are bigger than Shane Duffy.
Exactly. I mean, he's a beast. I mean, he's a beast even against
Chris
West
Wood,
Brom,
maybe, and possibly Sam Vokes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and precisely. They play for the same team. Yeah, so.
Precisely. So, yeah. But, you know, talking about the first half, yeah, it was a good, solid performance.
But we couldn't hand the ball when we got it forward. It wouldn't stick. I mean, we were talking about Hemed, sort of, he's not the best with his back to goal, and I'm going to look at him for this, but, you know, he, every time the ball went to him, it was just, it was non-stick, wasn't it?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously, that's the, with him, having him on his own up front, I don't think is, I don't think we're going to get many goals out of him, unfortunately.
Because Gross started right on the right-hand side, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it looked like we played a sort of 4-4-1-1 formation yesterday. And, you know, at times we'd sort of get the ball up to maybe just past halfway, but in terms of going any further than that, there didn't seem to be too many options, certainly in the first half. I think
I don't recall him having a chance, did he?
Not in the first half.
No, I mean, the notes I've got, I mean, there's not a huge amount of 8 minutes. Knockout makes a run, doesn't appear to be going anywhere, but takes a pot shot, shoots about a foot wide. Let's see. Sorry, this is a Bournemouth chance. Duffy fouls up and Dunk comes to the rescue. Reverse of what happened last week when Dunk having one of his beauties,
Duffy
was he?
Didn't have a good day yesterday, it's fair to say. He gave the ball away.
And yet, he was man of the match against West Brom.
And yet, West Brom, he was awesome. So, you know, but...
Well, if one fouls up, then the other one is going to step up. Yeah,
exactly. Old Dolly and Daisy Mark II, aren't they, really? Duffy and Dunk, they are, aren't they? Like Pallister and Bruce, a pair of them, you know.
Yeah.
They never confirmed which one was Dolly and which one was Daisy, but, you know, they are very
good luck
with
asking.
They are
them.
Very much the, you know, either the man to get passed or the ball to get passed, but not both, aren't they, Duffy and Dunk? They really are.
But one thing I did notice also is that I felt that Rossini was horribly exposed and I didn't feel that Knockhart was getting back. I mean, I don't know if you noticed this at all.
Yeah, I did. I think there's a couple of times, I think we were getting done on the overlap down our right when they were attacking.
Yeah.
Down their left, our right.
Yeah.
They played a couple of neat little overlaps that then allowed them to get the ball in.
Yeah.
Which was then obviously headed out by our dynamic
duo. Daisy,
yeah, exactly. I think there was a bit of friction there between Knockhart and Rossini. I think they were giving each other a bit of stick.
Which I found that they were doing actually in the first half. Well, Knockhart and Bruno were doing that kind of thing as well against West Brom. They were chirping at each other a little bit. I don't know about anyone else. I'm not sure Knockhart's made the step up yet, has he?
There's glimpses of it. Because he, you know, he was very good against Watford, and you know, he does a little, you know, he does his little party piece and his step overs, and a couple of time he did bamboos at West Brom. But out the two, you'd have to say Solly March has made the step up considerably more than Knockhart. Knockhart's got it in him. I think he's still a little kid in a sweet shop at the moment, and I think he just needs to, I don't know, knuckle down a bit.
Yeah.
He has come back from
a bit
injury,
more of a team
to be
player.
Fair. Yeah, you know, it's I really like Knockhart, but I still don't love him yet. Because there's still something about him which still is all about him, and I think, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think maybe he's sort of settled a little bit more. I think you could certainly see in the Championship that he did have that element of it's all about me, it's all about me. I think, you know, I truly didn't expect him to play exactly as he did and get away with the stuff that he did in the Championship as he would do in the Premier League, without a doubt. I think he's definitely still giving defenders something to think about.
Oh, yes.
You quite often see, you know, the opposition
he's
team
the
doubling
one that's
up
being
on
doubled
him.
And tripled up on in the way that Solly March isn't at the moment.
Well,
yeah,
this is
exactly.
It. That's the
exactly.
Thing.
Exactly.
You're right. He's been actually picked out probably more now in the Premier League because everybody knows about Knockhart and not many people know about Solly March. But there's a couple of times against Bournemouth where there's a little sort of montage of him bamboozling the player with a little, can't remember what it was, where he sort of lost him completely with one of his little fancy flicks. So yeah, he'll be fine. He's very hard to knock off the ball as well, Knockhart. He's like Maradona in that respect. Low centre of gravity. He's just, you know, you don't, once he's on it, that's it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So getting to the second half, and it's clear that we actually sort of start playing a little bit better. Duffy's causing carnage at a couple of corners. Stevens hits the bar, thanks to Duffy's knockdown. So yeah, corners is actually ought to be an important source of goals for, or at least a source of attempts for us this season. But 54 minutes, Gross is given time to cross. I think the defender was actually backing off from him quite a lot there. March is at the far post, and again, I thought their right back Francis had a poor game against him. I think he was done. The ball just went sailing over his head. March, I don't think he hardly jumped for it, and just nods it back into the way it came into the goal. And you know, of all the goals that March is ever going to score, you wouldn't actually necessarily go for a header, would you?
No, Trevor Booking didn't score many with me head, but
we're running out of time, so we're going to quickly go through the Bournemouth goals then. And we're frustrated, but they were, well, the first one I thought was actually a couple of decent bits of skill, wasn't it? The back
Jordan
heel, and then
as soon as he came
how
on,
how dare he?
Yeah,
we couldn't handle him, could we?
It's
really
supposed to be rubbish.
Whereas Aspinall said, you know, they played through the centre halves, which is a way to do it, you know, because they weren't going to get anything beating them. Durain Defoe, I mean, he's never going to win a header against Duffy.
No, but you leave him alone.
To
you,
see him next
as soon as it
to,
falls to
Duffy.
His feet in that 18-yard box, and and he didn't even look up when he scored. He literally got that ball.
You leave him alone in the penalty area. He's mustard, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, we were undone by two very good pieces of sort of skill / luck / whatever. Another day that would have been a point, or even maybe all three.
Absolutely. But some positives to take from it.
We're getting better every game. That was a much better performance than it was against Leicester away, for example.
We're not being hammered, are we?
Stink it out. And I don't think many teams are going to hammer us this season, to be honest.
Okay, well, I'm afraid to say that's all we got time for. Ihan, your first hour has flown by.
Certainly
now
has.
Now we've popped your cherry.
Ihan!
Mum's calling. But thanks very much indeed to Ihan Suleiman. Thanks very much indeed to Marcus Hancocks. You've been listening to the Albion Raw. My name's Alan Wares. Aidy will be back next week. And thanks very much for listening. Sorry to say that we always end up on the losing side. Cheers. Always end up